Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto talking to you from Dallas, Texas at 5 o'clock Central Time. And we're back to our 5 o'clock schedule. Last Thursday, we did the show at noon because of the July 4th holiday. But we're back at 5 o'clock, and that, of course, means 100-degree temperatures here in Dallas. And, of course, we like it. We don't have a problem with it. We've grown accustomed to that. And the one thing, as I've said before, 100 degrees means that I don't have allergies, and that's a good thing. Another quick note here before we get to our guest. I don't know how many of you heard this, but Ringo Starr of the Beatles turned 68. I think it was either yesterday or today. So Ringo Starr, happy birthday, Ringo, 68. It's hard to believe that a member of the Beatles is 68 years old, but is. Today we're very, very happy to have with a gentleman that I originally came across through a post that Ed Morrissey wrote on Hot Air, and he wrote a post about this gentleman. He has a blog, and of course I'm talking about Lieutenant Colonel Ken Repya, and he's up in Minnesota. Colonel, hello.
How you doing?
Good. I apologize. I didn't mess up your last name.
It's Joe, not Ken.
Joe, I'm sorry. Forgive me.
No,
Joe Repya.
Okay. The last name is Repya.
Repya. So forgive me for that, Colonel. I'll call you Colonel from now on, and that way I don't mess it up. That's the way. But as I mentioned, the last time, we had come across your post that you wrote about John McCain. But before we do that, tell us a little bit about your military story. It's a great story. We're so proud that there are people like you in this country who dedicate their lives to the military.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. I started with the U.S. military as a result of my college education, which they were kind enough to pay for through an ROTC scholarship, where I went to school at Western Michigan University. I was born and raised in Gary, Indiana, went to school in Kalamazoo at Western Michigan on an ROTC scholarship that allowed me to become a lieutenant in the United States Army, infantry, regular army, in 1969. Shortly thereafter, some training, was a rifle platoon leader in Vietnam with the 101st Airborne Division and the famous 2nd Battalion 506 Parachute Regiment, the Band of Brothers. After a year in Vietnam, I came back and eventually, a couple of years later, went to Army Helicopter Flight School and became an Army pilot. Over the next 28 years, I had numerous assignments, both as a pilot and as an infantry officer. I actually left active duty after nearly 10 years service, but continued as a member of numerous Guard or Army Reserve units. So I ended up with 28 years service, retiring in 1998 thinking that I had hung up the uniform for good, but then 9/11 happened, and some 12,000 Army retirees like myself volunteered to be available for the Army if they wanted to do a something they've done all the way back to the First World War, and that is a voluntary retiree recall. And out of the 12,000, my understanding that only 350 of us had been brought back as of this year. I came back to active duty on 2004, and I, again with the 101st Airborne Division, I should also mention that I served in Desert Storm back in 1990-91 with another famous Army division, the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One. And I was a staff officer and pilot for the aviation brigade of the Big Red One, once again on active duty. And so after joining the 101st for a period of time, I then deployed to Iraq to Camp Victory and worked as the senior liaison officer of the 101st Airborne Division facilitating bringing the division from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, into the battle space that we occupied in Iraq. I eventually returned home and left active duty in 2006. I should point out that when I re-entered active duty, I was already 58 years old, and when I retired, I was already 60 and a half years old. Returning back to Minnesota, where I'm, where my wife and family are, and the only thing I can tell you is some guys will do anything to get out of shoveling snow in Minnesota.
Okay. Well, you shouldn't have that problem right now, but you probably did a few months ago, because as I remember reading not only in Ed Morrissey's post, but also in the Power Line, you guys had a pretty bad winter, didn't you? I mean, it was
you had
a lot of snow, right?
A horrendous winter up here. As a matter of fact, it had me begging my wife for consideration of buying a home in the South. So, unfortunately, she has seven more years before she's eligible for retirement. And so we're probably going to do something like that when we have the opportunity.
Now, Colonel, you mentioned something that was very, very interesting. You mentioned about Desert Storm, and I made myself a note here to ask you a question. Over the last, before we get into our other subjects, but before I ask you that question, your wife and you are also active there in Minnesota supporting the troops and their families. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, it happened back in January of 2003. We were returning home one day from church, and one Sunday, and we were seeing a lot of signs popping up in Minneapolis and St. Paul that said, no blood for oil, no war for oil. And we, and having a nephew that was an Air Force captain at the time, we were a little concerned and quite concerned that, you know, this was heading the same direction that I saw Vietnam headed, and that is that, you know, the U.S. military would get the blame for decisions made on the political side of the house. And so my wife and I decided that somebody needed to make a statement, and for the heck of it, we decided to make a lawn sign of our own. So we printed up 250 lawn signs that had the American flag on it, and in very large red letters, Liberate Iraq, Support Our Troops. Call your congressperson. The reason we said Liberate Iraq is after the Gulf War, we had brought Iraqi refugees from that war to the United States, and some of them actually had, at least one of them, had his wife and child murdered by Saddam's secret police when they found out that this Air Force colonel was now in the United States. So we understood what a tyrannical regime was in place in Iraq, and believed very strongly that it needed to be replaced. It was one of the three evil empires that the president had outlined: North Korea, Iran, and Iraq. And they were a threat to the United States, regardless of how the Democrats would like to spin it today.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And what started with 250 lawn signs over a 10-week period of time ended up 30,000 lawn signs that were given out throughout Minnesota. We held a rally 2 days after the war started at the Capitol in St. Paul, where 20,000 Minnesotans and people from Wisconsin came out to rally to support the troops. And a very interesting thing happened along that 10-week period of time. 3 weeks into the sign campaign, we had so many death threats that we ended up having to wear bulletproof vests when we went in public, and I had to carry a concealed weapon.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah,
an amazing story.
It just shows you how peaceful the, anti-war crowd
is. Yeah, they are. They love free speech as long as they're talking, right?
It only applies to them.
That's right. Now, and you mentioned Desert Storm, and as I said, I made me a note here to the side because I wanted to ask you a question. We just learned about this yellow cake that was transferred to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
What does that say to you? Having where does that fit in Before we get into the regular, what I want to talk to you about, but just briefly, where do you think that fits in into the story of this war?
Well, there's undoubtedly, and I know from my personal experience, since I had a group of Iraqis surrender to my unit, one of which was in a very nice suit, I should point out, and he produced identification that he was an Iraqi nuclear physicist. And he was, and his comments were, I would like to speak to someone at the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait. I was working on the atomic bomb program for Saddam. And so I spirited him off to the American Embassy. So, Saddam was working on a program. To what extent that program was going on in 2003 when we actually invaded, I'll leave that up to the historians to decide. But the fact of the matter is, you have a guy that, who, as leader of his nation, brutalized his nation, attacked two of his neighbors, Iran and Kuwait, murdered over a million or more of his own people and a million or more of his neighbors in wars of aggression, and attempted to murder and have assassinated one of the United States presidents in Kuwait a number of years after the Gulf War.
That was Bush 41.
Definitely one of the world's bad actors needed to be replaced.
That's right. That's exactly right. I was just kind of curious because let me tell you my little theory, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this. I think that there's a lot of stuff going on in secret for strategic and tactical reasons about the weapons that he had and where they went. I don't think a lot of it is out. Eventually it will come out, as things usually do. But I think it's interesting to me that this yellow cake that would all of a sudden, you know, that we held this information secret for some time, probably because we didn't want terrorists to know that it was available somewhere where they could steal it, I guess. That would be my
naturally, because it could be used if it's obtained in large enough quantity for dirty bombs.
That's right. Okay, very good point. Now, let's get into the topic that originally attracted me. You're also a blogger, Colonel.
I have been for about 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, so welcome to the world of bloggers. I mean, this is
Eagle's
like...
Eagle's Nest blog, and it's and the reason I call it the Eagle's Nest, of course, the Eagle's Nest was Adolf Hitler's home in Bavaria. That was captured by by the Band of Brothers, the 2nd Battalion, the 506 Parachute Regiment, during World War II. And the Eagle's Nest blog is a way of honoring the men and women who have served in the 506 Parachute Regiment and serve today in the 506th Infantry Regiment, which is part of the 101st Airborne Division.
So I was reading Ed Morrissey's post on Hot Air, which I do quite frequently, and he had a reference to your blog, and then I went to your blog and read about it. Now, since you wrote that blog, of course, not only Wes Clark, but now former President Clinton is making statements about John McCain.
Isn't it interesting how President
It's insane,
Clinton
isn't it?
Has suddenly become a psychoanalyst. He's the Democrats' new psychologist, or psychiatric evaluator. You know, the very man that gave us Wes Clark, who he ended up having to relieve as the commander in Europe, and the man who gave us Paula Jones, Monica Lewinsky, and a whole bunch of other scandals, and the man who allowed Al-Qaeda to grow and flourish until they finally attacked us in 2000. One, and it became obvious that we had been at war with them since they declared war on us years earlier. It's amazing. And it sort of, if you've been reading my blog, you probably also read where I sort of questioned, is Wes Clark doing this for the Clintons? Are the Clintons doing this in a way so that they could sabotage Barack Obama's campaign? Or is Barack Obama's campaign so desperate to try to deflect John McCain's military background and his strong personal character that they are trying to in many ways, destroy the image of John McCain as the war hero that he is.
Yeah. We're talking to Colonel Joe Repia, a very distinguished military man who has spent over almost 30 years in military service, and we're talking about some of the stuff going on in politics today. The colonel also has a blog, and he came to my attention because of a blog, a post that he wrote about this whole McCain incident. Colonel, my view is that it's not going to work, because whether you like McCain or not, whether, you know, people have a lot of strong views about McCain. He does have tremendous respect, as I think most military people do, with the American public. I saw a Gallup poll, maybe you saw this too, that most Americans, an overwhelming number of Americans, believe that military service is an honorable thing. So I don't think it's going to work. I think it's going to backfire on Obama or whoever's doing it.
It's interesting. It just points out Barack Obama's weakness by constantly hammering John McCain on his military background and his military character. You know, here's a guy that spent 5.5 years in the Hanoi Hilton in a prisoner of war camp, who could have left years earlier because of his father being the top naval officer in the Pacific, and refused to do so until it was his turn to leave. In other words, send the guys that were captured before me home first, then when it's my turn, I will go. And because of that, of course, he received numerous beatings and torture as a result. Now, I have to admit that initially John McCain was not my personal choice in the primaries. Actually, I was Fred Thompson's national coordinator for veterans nationwide. But you know, when you really get down to what the choices are today, you have the choices of a slick-speaking Chicago politician who's just as just as tuned in to being politics as usual, who has come up with this mantra change, which nobody really understands what that change is, and keeps saying that he's going to be a different politician, and then proves just the opposite, that he's the same old, same old. Or you have a battle-tested, experienced individual who spent nearly 20 years in the House and Senate on the Armed Services Committee. Not a major national defense issue has gone through this country in the last 15 to 20 years where John McCain wasn't consulted on.
That's exactly right. I mean, John McCain has been, again, whether you like him or not, he's been in the middle of every major national, domestic, and foreign policy issue. He's been right in there. Sometimes, like you say, you know, a lot of us did not initially support him. I supported him. I have to go back to 2007. I was supporting him back in 2007, and then after, you know, after the summer and the fall of 2007, I just didn't think he was going to make it. Mm-hmm. So I went to work for Romney. Well, I mean, I was a volunteer for Romney, and then of course when. Like you, I went to McCain because we have a choice. I mean, the choice is very clear.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'll bring it down to a very personal level, Colonel.
I might point out that I don't work for the McCain campaign. All my statements on John McCain are my personal beliefs.
Yeah.
I'm not being paid in any way to speak for John McCain. However, I am thoroughly convinced that in the choice that we have in November, he is the man that I want to be the commander-in-chief come the day after the election.
Well, for me, it's a very personal choice, and I'll tell you why. My wife and I have three sons, two in college. We have one in high school who graduates in 2009, and he's almost 100% persuaded to go into the Marines. You know, if he chooses that, I'm very proud of him. And I will tell you, as a father of a potential young man serving in the military, for me, I would rather have my son serving President McCain than President Obama. Now, if it's President Obama, he'll do his duty and he'll serve him. But if I have a choice with my vote, I would rather have him serving President McCain, because I just don't think there's a choice between these two guys. One is so much more superior than the other. I just think experience matters a great deal on things like this, Colonel. You've been in the middle of many of these things from a military standpoint, and you've dealt with politicians, I'm sure. And experience matters a great deal.
Well, it does. And the important thing is that, John McCain will continue to fight the war on terror as a war. Barack Obama believes that it should be a police and court action. And I thoroughly disagree with that. That's the philosophy and the use, or what was the belief of the Clinton administration. As a result, we saw Al-Qaeda grow to a worldwide network that attacked us on 9/11 after attacking us on the fringes for quite some time, and even attacking the World Trade Center in 1993. But the Clinton administration just couldn't get it through their head that this was a bad actor and they needed to eliminate him, and they let him slip through their fingers numerous times until 9/11. And it's amazing that since 9/11, no major terrorist attack on our soil has taken place, thank God, and hopefully will not under a new administration, hopefully under a John McCain administration. I have a lot more confidence that that would be the case. So it's, I like to say, Wes Clark was poo-pooing John McCain's military background. Well, Wes Clark is no David Petraeus any more than Barack Obama is a John McCain when it comes to character.
Well, well said. We're talking to Colonel Joe Repia up in Minnesota. We're going to go over our 30 minutes, Colonel. If you have a little bit more time, I'd like to go beyond the 30 minutes, because
sure.
I've got two other topics here that I want to, maybe we'll go about 40 minutes. I've got two other topics here that I want to get into. The first one is Iraq, and sort of where are we right now in that war? What is your viewpoint of that? And then I want to get into Afghanistan and where you see that, because I guess that's the next one, I think. But tell us about Iraq. I mean, here we are 5 years after the invasion, a year and a half after the strategy changed. Where are we today, July 2008?
We're at a point that we've got Al-Qaeda on the run throughout Iraq. They can no longer mount large-scale operations. We have seen that the Sunnis and the Shia have reconciled to some extent. And really, the bottom line here, unlike what Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, Ted Kennedy, and Dick Durbin were saying a year ago, John Murtha I should throw in there, that we had lost the war, that we needed to get out immediately. And, oh, by the way, that's also what Barack Obama was saying. The bottom line here is we are winning the war. We have it nearly won. Even the Iraqi government is saying, we think now we can start setting some timetables for the withdrawal of U.S. combat forces. And we are withdrawing combat force strength even now to what they were prior to the surge, and plans are on the table to draw down even more. But it took a change of strategy. It took a strong general like David Petraeus to come in, who understands counterinsurgency warfare, and now General Petraeus is in charge of all of CENTCOM. And you will see that kind of tactics start moving towards the Afghanistan theater as well. But we are winning, and all I can say is to echo what the Veterans for Freedom say, and that is, let us win. And
that's the new ad that they're running, which is absolutely great. If you haven't seen it,
great organization, I'm proud to be part of.
Yeah, they're running a great ad, and they have a couple of veterans as well as the mother of a soldier over in Iraq who's talking out. Do you believe that the change in strategy in 2007 was the tipping point, or do you think that this would have happened without the change in strategy?
I think the change in strategy was what many of us who had been there were echoing, that it needed to be done. Probably should have came a year earlier, in the opinion of many of us. But war, like unfortunately, like some sporting events, don't always go the way you plan it. And you have to be able to, the Dallas Cowboys, Tony Romo doesn't always have his play calling down pat. He has to change during the course of the game. Well, in war, where people's lives are on the line, tactics have to change. The ideas have to change. The equipment has to change. And all these things have been taking place the entire time we've been in Iraq. We went into Iraq with an army that was designed to destroy Soviet-style armies on the battlefields of Europe, and we've now adapted to a counterinsurgency-type warfare with vehicles that can withstand, in many respects, tremendous explosive devices aimed at them, and still save the lives of those inside those vehicles. We've got, the surge has worked. We've had the Iraqi stand up and start defending themselves. Their military is a lot stronger than it was when I was there in 2005. Their police forces are getting better. We've disarmed or killed a number of the insurgents and the criminal elements and these gangs of militia that were running rampant in Iraq. And the Iraqi government is a lot stronger than it ever was. And so we are making progress, and that's why there's a tremendous hush in the halls of Congress on the Democratic side by the Nancy Pelosi's, the Harry Reid's, the Dick Durbin's, and the Barack Obama's on what is happening in Iraq. Now they are changing their tune to say, well, we should have been in Afghanistan all this time. Two different wars, entirely different scenarios, completely different.
And that's what I want to get into next, Colonel, Afghanistan. I didn't mean to cut you off there. Go ahead and finish.
In Iraq, where you need battalions and brigades, combat brigades on the ground, Afghanistan is a more small unit involvement type an area. You have areas in eastern Iran and western Pakistan that are so difficult to get into that the tribal relationship is so strong, there's no way you're going to penetrate it. We've seen the British bog down in Afghanistan and destroyed. We've seen the Russians bog down in Afghanistan and destroyed. The last thing America needs to do is to do what the Democrats say, and that is to put 100,000 troops into eastern Afghanistan, into those mountains. For crying out loud, if we haven't learned anything from those experiences or the experiences of the Germans in Yugoslavia in World War II, where 5 or 10 well-armed guerrillas or insurgents could hold off entire battalions and brigades 50 times their size, we need to be taking a lesson from history. So that's my belief. It would be a tremendous error to do what the Democrats and Barack Obama are saying they need to do, and that is to put 100,000 more troops in Afghanistan.
We're talking to Colonel Joe Repia up in Minnesota, and we're talking about a variety of issues. The Colonel is also a blogger. The Eagle's Nest, right? That's the name
of
the blog. Yeah. Eagle's Nest blog. And the last subject, and the Colonel brought it up, is this whole question of Afghanistan, because the Democrats have been, I think, very conveniently using the Afghanistan war as a way of saying we should have gone into Afghanistan. Now, of course, we did go into Afghanistan, Colonel. We sent, we've got 27,000 troops there. The Brits have 7. The Canadians are doing a great job in Afghanistan. There's a lot of other countries that don't fight.
A lot of countries have rallied to the cause. It's a large country. It's got a 23 million population. But those areas, those mountains, are very difficult to operate in. And you have these, you have the Taliban, who have been reduced and no longer control the country. but they do have their armies in the mountains, along with the Al-Qaeda foreign fighters, and they're back and forth across the Pakistani border, where they're being supplied, and they're housed and armed, and that war is going to take a long time, but that war is going to have to be fought with special operations, small units, pinpointing and then taking out high-value targets, as we've been doing, and to go in there with a massive land army would be a fool's folly, believe me.
Yeah, and that's what I have always felt, that it's going to have to be a very unique kind of operation, and the Democrats keep talking about, well, we should send more troops in there. I'm not sure if it's a question of troops, as it is, like you say. It's a question of special forces and sort of cutting
the
state.
Democrats are saying that because they have to have something to try to deflect their ineptitude when it came to supporting the Iraq war. You have to remember, a lot of these Democrats voted to give the president power to go to war. And then when the war suddenly wasn't going as well as the American people would like it to, they immediately tried to put the blame and spin it so that they were led to and fooled by this crafty Texas politician named George W. Bush, that he somehow lied to them and twisted the intelligence. Well, that's a bunch of bull feathers. You know it, and I know it.
Yeah.
And they knew they had the same intelligence that he was looking at, and they were all for it when they thought it was going to end. You know, after Saigon fell, boy, they were thumping and beating themselves on the chest, saying, "Hey, what a great job America has done." But as the insurgency started, and we started having to deal with that, then they saw an excuse to start attacking Bush and the Republicans, and they've been doing that ever since.
That's right.
Disgraceful, to be.
No, it is really, and I agree with you, because, you know, if to me that they have been political cowards when it comes to the Iraq War. If they don't like the Iraq War and they want to end it, they have a process to do that. Is you cut the funding. I mean, if that's
exactly
what they really believe, you cut the funding.
They got elected 2 years ago in 06, saying that that's what they would do if they were elected to and took over Congress. They'd stop the war by cutting the funding.
Right.
Well, naturally, once they got there, the realities were exactly the opposite, and they didn't do it.
But
now
I mean,
you have a Barack Obama saying the same thing. I'll get the troops out. Now he's doing the old tap dance of, well, maybe, you know, I'll talk to the generals on the battlefield first, and although I'm committed to getting the troops out, it may take longer. Well, the reality is, I don't think if he does get elected, he's not going to want to be the one responsible for pulling the troops out, watching Iraq become a satellite state of Iran, and watching millions of Iraqis who supported the Americans suddenly be slaughtered the way that the Vietnamese were slaughtered after Vietnam fell in 1975, and 3 million people in that region died as a result of their working with the United States government. And that was devastating to the Democratic Party then. It will be even more devastating to the Democratic Party in the future here.
Not only that, he's probably going to have to send troops back in.
What George Patton used to say, I don't like to pay with blood for the same terrain twice.
That's right. Well, Colonel, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We went a little bit longer than we normally do, but that's because it was so interesting. What is that blog again?
It's the Eagle's Nest blog, and I appreciate anybody that blogs on and makes a comment. We try to stay abreast of things as the world events as possible. Like I said, I'm a new guy at this, so cut me a little slack there, but. We try to hit the topics that would interest people, not only here in Minnesota in the Minneapolis area where I live, but throughout the country, especially if it has to do with the United States military, our troops, and the families of our troops who are just as dedicated to winning this war on terror as the troops themselves are.
I have to ask you, though, I saved the most difficult question for last, Colonel, and that is, do you think the Twins are going to put on a big rush here in the second half?
Well, that was a tough game to lose 1-0 to Boston last night. I mean, they had twice, they had bases loaded, and they couldn't get that run, couldn't get a run in. You know, the Twins are a very young team. Many of us who are staunch Twin supporters, and I am, I'm a season ticket holder. We go down to spring training, my wife and I. We thoroughly believe that if the Twins were to finish third or fourth this year, that would be okay. To have them only a game and a half back from first, to see this young pitching gel as well as they're doing, to see these young players like Gogo Gomez and Casilla and the others step up. We've got three guys going to the All-Star, Joe Mauer, Justin Morneau, and Joe Nathan, probably the best closer in the baseball right now. We're just amazed. This is going to be a team, and of course we're getting a brand new stadium being built right now that will open in 2010. By the way, it will not have a roof, so those games in April and May might be very interesting.
Well, like the old Bloomington Stadium.
Well, they might have to turn around and make the ball orange just to see it in the snow. I don't know.
Yeah, I remember the old Bloomington Stadium. I went there a couple of times with our family. I got to tell you a little Twin story that you'll appreciate. I was originally born in Cuba, and our family came to the United States in 1964. And we lived in at the time in Wisconsin. And, of course, the Braves were moving out of Milwaukee at the time, so I never fell in love with the Braves. But I did fall in love with the Twins because they were four Cuban players on the team. You may remember them, Tony Olivas, Oilo Versailles, Camilo Pascual, and Sandy Valdespino. They were four Cuban players on that 1965 team that went on to win the American League pennant. So our whole family fell in love with the Twins, and my mom, my dad, and the three of us would drive up to Bloomington whenever possible to, like, once or twice a year to see our favorite Cuban players. And so I've always had a wonderful place in my heart for the Twins, even though I've never lived up there. But that Bloomington Stadium was a nice stadium, but you're right, it was cold in April.
Well, I'm going to give you a Tony Oliva story if we got time.
All right, go for it. Three-time batting champion.
Yes. Last year, a dear friend of mine who is, we brought his widow and two little boys here from Houston, Texas, for a five-day visit at three Twins games. This young man was killed on Mother's Day 2006, a Texas A&M graduate. He's buried there in Houston, in Dallas, Texas, at the National Cemetery. I attended his funeral the end of May of 2006, after I got back from Iraq. He was shot down in Iraq in his, as an Army helicopter pilot. He and his co-pilot were killed when they were their gunship was shot down. His widow and two little boys came up. The boys are 4 and 6. We got them down on the playing field with the Twins before the game. And Tony was walking by. And I motioned for Tony to come over. I whispered in his ear that these little boys, their dad was killed in Iraq. And he spent the longest time talking to them, autographed their Twins jerseys, and was just the sweetest guy to these little boys as you could ask for. And it's my hope someday, and someday in the near future, that you, Tony, and if I'm available, can come along, can sit in a free Havana, smoke a Cuban cigar, have an adult beverage, and toast baseball.
Well, that would be absolutely great. And, of course, hopefully before that or soon after that, Tony will be inducted in the Hall of Fame.
He deserves it.
He deserves it.
Along with Bert Blyleven, two Minnesota Twins that I hope someday will be Hall of Famers.
That's right. I mean, Tony Oliva. In fact, I remember reading a book, and I wish I could find it, but I saw it in the library, and then I was never able to find it anywhere else, but it was a book about, written by some sports writer, and he listed the 100 greatest players who are not in the Hall of Fame, and number two on that list was Tony Oliva. Absolutely. I mean, Tony Oliva.
I tell you what, you want to come up here to Minnesota, Minneapolis sometime, and go to a Twins game, you just give us a call. We'll drag Ed Morrissey with us, and I guarantee if we do, I'll contact my friends at the Twins, and we'll figure out a way to visit with Tony.
Well, that would be absolutely great. That would be absolutely great.
Got a lot of tickets in September, so come on.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, before the snow flies.
That's right, Colonel. Thank you very much.
Up here for the Republican National Convention.
Well, I won't be. I won't be making it this year. I didn't make the cut, as they say. But there's a lady that that I know who's going to be going up there. In fact, we're going to do a show from. She's going to talk to us from the convention. But that should be a lot of fun up there with the Republicans up there. I'm sure Ed Morrissey is going to have a great time with his radio show up there and the convention. But, Colonel, thank you very much for joining us. It was indeed a great pleasure. I will send you a link so that you can have this for you and for your family. As a citizen of the United States, naturalized and very proud citizen of the United States, I want to thank you for your service to the United States, and please give our best to your wife.
The honor has been mine for visiting with you, but more importantly, the honor to serve America has been, for me, the greatest accomplishment in my lifetime next to my wife and children.
Thank you very much. Have a great week up in Minnesota.
Thank you.
This is Silvio Canto signing off. We went a little bit longer than usual, but I think you'll appreciate that the subject was absolutely the very best. Colonel Joe Repia, have a wonderful weekend, Colonel, and we'll talk to everybody on Thursday, July 10th at 5 p.m. Central Time. This is Silvio Canto saying goodbye, and thank you very much for listening. Again, our thanks to Colonel Joe Repia. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.